For over a century, the medium of radio has created a unique intimacy between broadcasters and their audience like no other art form. Echoing and celebrating the changing face of popular culture, radio stars occupy a certain space in the story of entertainment. In this series, some of Britain's most recognisable voices reflect on their own relationship with the original content creator. So, join us as we celebrate the power and magic of radio exclusively on Beyond the Title.
Ever since Itmar dominated the airwaves and gave Britain something to laugh at during the atrocities of the Second World War, radio comedy has occupied a very significant part of the light entertainment story. Everyone from the Goons to Mitchell and Webb owe a large amount of their success to the wireless, a world of endless possibilities where the pictures are always better. As part of Beyond the Title's radio season, I caught up with writer and impressionist John Coleshaw to celebrate the magic and legacy of the spoken word. Let's talk radio comedy. So John, welcome back to Beyond the Title and to our very special radio celebration. Firstly, what are your earliest memories of radio and who were your radio heroes growing up?
Oh, my goodness. My first memories of radio, I think, Josh, were, I think it was my dad listening to Radio 4 on a very wonderful Regent Tone 1960s radio. And it was a portable one. And he carried it with him everywhere he went. So usually in the kitchen in the 1970s, the programmes would be, "We present quote unquote." And now it's time for You and Yours. We present Desert Island Discs, these sorts of shows. But my dad was also, he was also a great carpenter and woodworker and craftsman. And he'd take this trusty little radio into the shed. And I used to go and watch him work and the aroma of wood shavings filling the shed. And the little radio would be there as well. Radio 4, this sort of comforting, formal tone. Just emanating from the corner, that sort of followed every chapter of life, really. Yeah. So that was my first memory.
Did you ever
did you ever think that you'd appear on Radio 4?
No idea at all. Absolutely no idea whatsoever. My dad used to listen to Radio 4 on Saturday nights as well. Those programmes, you know, My Music with Frank Muir and John Amos and these wonderful characters, or My Word. But I never knew that I would appear on Radio 4. I can remember my first experience of radio was at Ormskirk Hospital, Radio Ormskirk General, back in 1986, and I was 17 or 18 then, and I used to volunteer at the local hospital radio, I used to want to play all the hits of the time from Kool and the Gang and Duran Duran and so on, but the patients, they always wanted to hear One Day at a Time by Lena Martell, so we had to play that, but that was sweet enough. But yes, the idea that I would have, listening to Radio 4 in those days when I was very young in the 70s, the fact that you might appear there yourself on a programme like Dead Ringers, I'm sorry I haven't a clue, doesn't cross your mind at all. It really doesn't. And I always remember that, actually, if ever I do participate in a Radio 4 programme. I think memories of those days, there's always a connection through to it. So it's always good to hold on to things like that.
As a radio star, you have been both presenter and performer with both huge success. What's easier?
Oh, my goodness. Being a presenter, I did enjoy those days of being a DJ on local radio. And I think that part of the joy of that is you get to know a specific area. And it gives you a chapter of memories. I remember Red Rose Radio in Preston in Lancashire, my home county, and the memories there of just sort of getting started, learning the ropes a little bit. I remember working on Pennine Radio in West Yorkshire and just getting to know that area as well. Viking FM in Hull. I loved working in Hull. I loved how maritime it was. I loved the Humber Bridge. being near to the water and that whole fishing industry heritage. Hull, I found a very kind place to work in. And I've got great, great friends from there. So I was immensely contented there. So, yeah, it was fun presenting on the radio. The chance to perform material from great, great comedy writers in a show such as Dead Ringers and so on, that is maybe because you're getting the chance to perform other people's material rather than presenting it yourself. Maybe that's easier than building an entire show, but it just gives you different challenges, learning the new voices, getting the comic timing as much as you can. But I'll always be grateful to be one of the team of Dead Ringers, because the Dead Ringers script is a much nicer way to get your news. the current affairs and events softened in the comic script. It's better to get it that way than watching the real news, I think.
Yeah.
So throughout history, radio and television have enjoyed a symbiotic relationship when creating stars. Everyone from Tony Hancock to Simon Dee, Noel Edmonds, Chris Evans to Fern Cotton via Chris Moores and Zoe Ball have made this rite of passage. What do you think it is about radio which remains the perfect testing ground for broadcasting success?
I think it's because you've got to have a sense of personality. You've got to be a good communicator, a good storyteller, that ability to create an atmosphere and also keep with the schedule of the broadcast itself. And if you can knit that together in radio terms, then many also can take on an extra dimension and do it in televisual terms as well. Sometimes it doesn't always go that way. There might be people immensely strong on television. On the radio, they might get slightly lost. Radio is a very specific medium and style of presentation.
Yeah.
There might be those who can command radio beautifully, but television doesn't quite feel at home. So it's always a mercurial thing. You never can quite tell. But I think just being a good storyteller, a good communicator, I often like it when the beauty of it is one broadcaster on the radio, they will have a certain style. They'll do a certain type of programs. When they go onto television, they might do something entirely different. I've always found that the sort of radio that I've done and the sort of TV that I've done are in different universes, really. That's great when you have that chance. But at the root of it, is just being a good communicator, being a good storyteller. That would be the line of it, I think.
What's the difference between a broadcaster who has the talent to be funny and a comedian who can also be a radio presenter?
Oh, my goodness, yes. I think knowing the two sensibilities. if you're a comedian who can command rapturous laughter on the stage of the Apollo or the O2, to then be able to read the situation in a radio studio where it's very different. The microphone is there in front of you. It's one-to-one. You're just talking to one listener. There's probably, you know, many thousands, millions listening, but the feel of it, the sense of it is you're just talking to one person. I always find that really, really interesting. When you think of somebody such as Frank Skinner, who can command a huge auditorium. And when he's on the radio, it's much more conversational. You get to see this other side of people. The anecdotes come, them being a raconteur. Radio is wonderful in how it will bring out another side to somebody altogether. Terry Wogan, a terrific example. His radio broadcasts had this beautiful sort of, you know, this great warmth and presence and so on. And it was like, you know, Terry was there in your kitchen or your front room, just very relaxed. Yeah. And when he needed to command the TV screen, he did that as well. The differences and the different approaches you need to have, it's always fascinated me that.
Got
as well. He got away with more edgy material on radio than he did on television.
Oh, yes. Yes, because, you see, that little twinkle would always be there, you know. Just that sort of, yes, I'm just saying this mischievous thing. Just between you and me, you understand. Yes. He had that beautiful skill of, you know, he could get away with the, you know, some of the more mischievous material. If you deliver that with an annoying twinkle and with that unmistakable warmth, yes, it's, I mean, you know, Terry is regarded as the very, very best and with good reason.
Famously, back at the dawning of the millennium, you contributed funny pranks on Chris Moore's show. In hindsight, to what extent was this merely a subtle evolution of the radio rebellion of the past?
Yes, I think, yes, radio has always found a sense of benevolent mischief. You know, there's always been, people have always enjoyed that. With those calls with Chris or with Steve Penk on Capital Radio or on Dead Ringers, what you want to end up doing is making sure that everybody is laughing at the end of it. Everyone gives their permission for the call to be broadcast and everybody has to laugh about it. So that's rather nice. And there's got to be a sort of an innate silliness to it. Barry Cryer would always say, never lose touch with silly. Silliness is always the greatest thing. And if you have that, then that's a great basis. Barry Cryer always said that. And I think those comic phone calls have to be silly. One that's just come to mind now. Yeah, I remember phoning up with Mick Jagger. Mick Jagger phoning up a taxi company, trying to book a lift to Trampton or Chigley. Just the following merriment and confusion that follows. You can have a laugh with that, but it's got to be good-natured. It's got to be a sweetness to it.
Josh has never heard anybody do a Barry Cryer impression. That was quite good.
Yes, he's so missed and he's so loved. And he always had an interest in the comedy of that moment. He never rested on his laurels. He always was interested in what was happening right now and the new comedians coming through and following the new style of comedy. And he always had a wonderful contribution, an observation to make, and just so loved, so loved. And yes, a great writer who understood comedy so well and the different ways that comics work, you know, with the great Les Dawson, for example. Write and give him the material, but give him room. You've got to give him room to express himself in his way. He knew and read comedians and comic performers so well. He recognised what they needed and what made them so great, which is why so many, Morecambe and Wise, Les Dawson, Kenny Everett, Mike Yarwood, they all loved working with Barry. Yeah, much missed.
Yeah,
Yeah, Josh is glad that he actually got the chance to interview him.
Oh, fantastic. Yes, he would have been just magnificent. Magnificent. It's nice to just remember him for as often as possible.
The 29th of May, 1951, shall forever hold significance in the story of British radio comedy. How integral was the Goon Show in pushing the boundaries of radio and changing the perception of comedy?
Oh, yeah, the power of imagination, the power of anarchy, the power of being beautifully silly, beautifully surreal. Radio had been, especially in those days, enormously formal. So much of it sounded like this. So all of a sudden, when you have he's falling into water and I'm walking backwards for Christmas and Eccles and all of these glorious things, completely groundbreaking, completely. And it just kicked open the door for so many innumerable programs that have followed since. Just the joy of the surreal, but presented in a real skillful, imaginative way. Joyful. 1951, when you think, way, way back. Wow. You had the birth of rock and roll, and comedy had its own birth of rock and roll going on as well.
Yeah. It's
amazing when these chapters where things change unrecognisably. That was one of them.
Spike Milligan's turbulent relationship with the BBC is well documented, but how do you think that the fact that the Goons were on radio offered the show more scope to get away with political material, which would have been inappropriate for television?
Yes, radio's always had that bravery, hasn't it? Radio has always had that sense of strength of, this is where we try things out. This is where we give things a run. This is where there's just a little bit more freedom. And that did allow for, you know, the great, that sense of experimentation, which the BBC has always tried to hold close. You know, so many great things, so many great, great programmes were born off the back of a brave head of comedy or some inventive executive somewhere saying, well, let's give it a try. Let's give it a try and see how this goes. The Goons was a perfect example. And so, so many. The Young Ones, countless programmes like that. Those who say, let's just give it a try. Shooting Stars. Those brave executives who give things a chance. And wow, when they fly, then they last forever. And they influence generations of comics to follow. So it's very, very valuable. So valuable.
How do you think shows like The Navy Lark and Take It From Here help to cultivate the modern British sense of humour?
Yes, I think the wonderful sense of the teams working together, those great individuals within it. John Pertwee on the Navy Lark, one of my favourite characters. That lovely resonance and that sharp resonance, John Pertwee. As the Doctor and the great raconteur. I think we just loved to hear actors of that calibre just performing together, that beautiful timing. Just to hear these great, great minds and these great, great profound characters interacting together, the timing, the greats such as Kenneth Williams and Hancock. People love that. Put that creative formality together and let the anarchy flow all around it. It's very the best of both worlds, the discipline and the instinct coming together. I think that's the force of it. And they remain timeless. You know, you listen to the Navy Lark now and it's, you know, still just as impressive. It's still just as joyful to hear those wonderful people work, just to hear them work.
I'm sorry, I'll read that again. Was arguably one of the first radio comedies to incorporate satire. How far do you think this was able to move satire forward, and to what extent is it easier to push the comedy boundaries on radio, which you can't on television?
I suppose you have that immediacy. You have that chance of, you know, here was a way of using comedy to get at the truth, to get beneath what is spun and what is presented. And satire having that real joy to do that. Particularly interesting in these days, because it wasn't too long before this where we had things such as what was known as the Green Book, a book listing names and people that you could and certainly could not impersonate. Royalty was off the mark, the politicians were off the mark, you couldn't go near this. But it was the inventiveness and the sense of challenge that came from these great broadcasters and these great, great programmes, which was just pecking away at that, just, you know, freeing up comedy to have this voice, to not only run through the gags and run through the silliness, but also to challenge things. We saw this come through on television with That Was the Week That Was. Dave Allen, who I admire enormously. Love Dave Allen. He was one of those comedians who not just told the gags, but he also challenged things. And I think he was a great precursor of the comedians today who do that. He just pushed that door open and just showed the path. We owe a lot to Dave Allen.
No, I did.
Josh has read the Green Book, and it's funny that if you look at it nowadays, it's funny what they find as unsuitable.
Yes, exactly. They were worried about that. You can imagine. What are you worried about? Come on, people, snap out of it.
You weren't allowed to say like somebody is pregnant.
Yes. If we were to time travel and show them a few clips from the modern era. Good Lord! The minister will give spare. And from the hill that I shall need to sit down.
Yeah, played an episode of Celebrity Juice.
Good heavens, they would think that society has ceased to be. This fellow called Keith Nibbon, who resembles a form of Henry VIII in gaudy clothing, has been behaving quite appallingly, doing dreadful jokes about bodily particles, and heaven knows what. It's a disgrace. It's a disgrace. Cancel it. Cancel it. Yeah. Ah, then that brings us around to the present day again, doesn't it? Yes. Yeah.
Indeed. Educating Archie remains unique in giving rise to the art of ventriloquism on radio, but how do you think Peter Brough's notorious ventriloquist techniques added to the success of the show, and how important was this show in giving a platform to comedy stars which would go on to dominate British comedy?
Yeah, I think it's regarded so fondly, isn't it, that Peter Brough wasn't the greatest ventriloquist, you know. I think that added to the charm and the lovability of that. I rather admire that, you know, he just pressed ahead regardless of that, you know. yes, I think he did. So many people look to him, and it did open up this other world, taking the sense of a music hall speciality act and offering it up to broadcast and demonstrating how the new technologies available would actually communicate it. A ventriloquist on the radio, there's something so charmingly absurd about that. but yeah, it provided its inspiration. And yeah, I think he's regarded with fondness that... I'm trying to remember another joke that that Barry told. It was a joke about when you could see his lips moving, but I can't quite remember the phraseology. I'll come back to that in the bulletin.
It was Beryl Reed that said it. It was she was asked, "Can you see Peter's lips moving?" And it's only when Archie called.
That's it. I can just imagine that coming from Beryl Reed as well. I love those acerbic lines delivered in a beautifully soft way, as Beryl would have done. Yeah.
Archie Andrews and Peter Brough famously developed a winning ventriloquist act on radio, which came unstuck when they transferred to TV. What reservations did you hold when Dead Ringers moved to TV?
Oh, I don't think there were any reservations. I think we were aware of the new sort of opportunities it gave us. Yeah, just to echo what we were saying before, Dead Ringers on radio and TV, very, very different beasts. Different show, really. Dead Ringers on the radio had it was ever so Radio 4. It had a Radio 4 sensibility, but the inner rebellion within it. And we would do programmes such as The Archers and You and Yours and the Today programme, very, very Radio 4-ish. When it went over to TV, you took the sort of same cheekiness of the writing, the same style of the writing, often described as a cross between Private Eye and the Beano. And you would apply it to TV programmes, Newsnight, the 10 o'clock news, movies, Lord of the Rings, Gladiator, Doctor Who. And so the targets were different. And it gave us a different style of comedy. You could do visual gags. You could do sight gags. You could do exaggerations of on the visuals. So it gave us other things to play with. So, yeah, the Dead Ringers on the TV was a sort of a cousin of the radio version of it, rather than a direct version translated across, because it provided so many more different things.
This is a podcast celebrating radio comedy. Then we must talk about the legendary Roy Hudd. How significant was the news Hudd lines and bringing satire back into mainstream comedy? And what is his legacy within radio comedy?
Oh, wonderful. Roy Hudd was such a great, great energy and such a beautiful, larger than life performer with a brilliant comic mind. I love the way that he put the sense of satire was there in this wonderful, joyful, accessible program. He blended variety with satire. And that was a beautiful way of heightening the ridicule, really. Really making these characters, you know, look even more ridiculous, but in a very, very joyful way and with great, great warmth and with great, great skill. The show, as well as having the comedy all its own, sort of orbiting around that, it just had a glow, really. It did. It just had a glow. I think the radio emitted a sort of a certain shimmering light, even with it just being on, because of the energy of it. In the early days of Dead Ringers, the Hudd lines would have been recorded just as we arrived in. They would have, June Whitfield and Chris Emmett and Roy Hudd were there at the radio theatre, and they'd just recorded their show just as we were coming in to read through the Dead Ringers script for our recording in the evening. So it was a lovely crossover, that. And, yeah, a very well-loved and admired show.
Kenny Everett remains an important figure in the history of British radio comedy. In your opinion, how was he able to bridge the gap between popularist mainstream radio and the comedy fraternity?
Oh, Kenny Everett's just a brilliant imagination. His inventiveness and that sense of rebellion. He never wanted to do anything that was just, you know, a sort of a standard set of jokes or sketches. He's absolutely filled it with his imagination, this beautiful sense of naughtiness and inventiveness, and just this twinkle, hello. You just think of him and you smile. And there was no limit to his imagination at all. No limit whatsoever. And I remember seeing an interview with him on Parkinson when he was alongside Billy Connolly. And he was sat there just making these observations. And his own self was very understated, really. And I love that. The comedy ideas were so huge and imaginative and brilliant. But yet he himself so understated. But a unique imagination. And I love the stories of him building his radio shows together and the inventiveness in the sound and the editing. He'd spend exhaustive hours just editing and creating these things together, almost in a microscopic way. And this beautiful, I think the greatest compliment ever given to Steve Wright was that he kept Kenny Everett on his toes. And that's a real compliment. But yeah, incandescent inventiveness. That was Kenny Everett.
Impressionism on radio was something extremely seldom before Dead Ringers. What was the attitude of the upper echelons of BBC management towards the idea of the show?
Oh, I think, yes, programme controller at the time, I think it was James Boyle, came up with an idea. He said, we'd like a sort of comedy show featuring impersonation on Radio 4, a topical comedy show. And they went to Bill Dare with that idea. And I think Bill Dare had then a conversation with John Holmes, the great comedy writer and creator of The Skewer, which is an inventive piece of brilliance right now, winning all the awards, as it should. And they came up with this idea of taking the very well-behaved, formal Radio 4 programmes and characters and put some real satire and naughtiness with them. And to hear the Radio 4 characters saying such things, to hear Brian Perkins talking as a sort of some sort of mafia don with this quiet, understated tone, was just a beautiful juxtaposition. And you can't take the Mickey out of the Archers. You can't say that about the Archers. Well, yes, you can. And we did it. And yeah, people love the cheek of it. And it's got its own idea, Dead Ringers. It's got its own, the comedy has its own sensibility. It's not just a case of running through the gags and the inventiveness of the sketches that the brilliant writers put together, Tom Jameson, Nev Fountain, Lawrence Howarth, and the entire team. It sort of has its own feeling on things. It's sort of got its own attitude somewhere. And yeah, impressions is simply the way that it communicates. Mm. But yes, it's as I say, it's how I like to get the news. It's how I like to get my my news. Rather than, I'd much rather have the Dead Ringers script than a real news bulletin, that's for sure.
On television, it's easy to create shorthand observations which give the audience an explicit indication both about the people and the situation that are being satirised. How reliant are you on the radio audience to have a level of knowledge in which to find the joke in whatever you're performing?
Yeah, it's lovely. With a Radio 4 audience, you do feel spoilt. When the radio theatre crowd come in and they're sat there, they really feel like kindred spirits, and they're a very, very smart audience. And that's very, you can't wish for better than that. That they know the characters, they know the situations, they know Radio 4, and it's just a perfect blend. And on days when some of those shows when we've been we've recorded at lunchtime, and the programme will be broadcast just in a few short hours later, on the day of a general election, for example, or the day of the EU referendum. We were broadcast very close to transmission then. And when the story itself is so alive and that the audience are so much part of you with it, it makes for a real strong combination. So, yeah, we're lucky that the audiences are so, so smart. And it's magic the way that they react. Yeah, perfect combination.
Thinking about your own radio career, what does radio mean to you?
Oh, it means... It feels like home. It really does. It feels like home. I love the immediacy, the intimacy, just talking one-to-one, same person. And there's a freedom to it. There's a warmth to it and a versatility to it. And I think it's testament that it's never gone away. It's only ever strengthened. Nothing takes away from it. And yeah, the way that you can have an idea, and on radio it can be broadcast 10 minutes later. Sometimes on the Steve Wright Show on Radio 2. Sometimes I might have thought of an Alan Bennett thing, and I'd just record it on a voice note on the phone and email it to him, and he might have played it about 10 minutes later. The immediacy and that one-on-one connection with the audience. You can't beat radio for that.
And finally, why is radio important to popular culture?
Because it's a great way of just getting to the truth. It's a great way of, here's all the things we've been saying, the one-to-one sense, the freedom of it. And also, it's just a great vehicle for ideas and for news and for everything. And it can create so many endless atmospheres. When you think of all the reasons why you may love radio, the reasons that come back to you are just endless, absolutely endless. I love listening to the shipping forecasts, you know, in the heart of the night with a little final tincture, you know, a little glass of Tennessee honey, listening to the shipping forecasts. That just takes your imagination off somewhere. Listening to the great broadcasters that we've been talking about today, Kenny Everett, Terry Wogan, and so on, listening to their skill and just listening to how inventive radio continues to be. It's a crucible of supporting invention and creativity. And yes, it is a medium that will never leave us.